You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Alice Ree, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Now, it's often tough to get by in New York City. Look, we all have our complaints, from the traffic to the noise, and yes, those weekend subway changes that are as hard to decipher as classical Latin. Now, imagine what it's like for the people who come to this city as refugees. They barely speak English, or none at all, and some are suddenly transplanted here because of chaos and violence in their home country. The UN says that some 40 million people around the globe have already been uprooted by violence and persecution. And you may not have caught this in the headlines, but yesterday was World Refugee Day. Now, some of those refugees call New York City home. And in today's Underreported, you'll hear from some of New York's very young refugees. So with me now, Christine Petrie with the International Rescue Committee, and Fatou Sano. She's 19 years old and used to call Liberia home. She moved with her family to New York 2 years ago. I'm also joined by Nonam Tikam. She's 20, Burmese, and arrived in New York 3 years ago via Thailand. Ladies, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show. To all of our listeners, I want to mention that we will be taking your calls. So if you're listening, you've been a refugee, you've worked in the field, or just have a great comment for us, do give us a shout at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. All right, Christine, what is a refugee? How does international law designate a person a refugee?
Well, a refugee is somebody who has fled their homeland because of a well-founded fear of persecution. A refugee is typically outside of their native country and is in need of a durable solution in order to either return to their country or be resettled in a third country.
But who decides who becomes a refugee? Can I call myself a refugee? I'm from Canada and I live in New York. Am I a refugee? Who decides?
Well, basically, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees is the primary entity that designates individuals as refugees. And here in the U.S., organizations like the International Rescue Committee work with our U.S. government partners to assist refugees who are approved for resettlement in the U.S.
So you're essentially saying that you have a situation, you're in a country, you're facing persecution or some violence or something traumatic, and you apply either to the UN or to another country and say, I'd like to be designated as a refugee.
That's typical. Individuals would usually register okay. with the UN.
Now, give us the raw numbers. I don't know how you comprehend, how one can really understand the crisis for refugees around the globe right now. So what kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Well, the estimates are some 14 million refugees there are 14 million refugees worldwide, and probably an additional 10 million or so who are internally displaced within their own countries.
Okay. So what about New York City? Who comes here? Tries to come here, actually, I should say.
New York City, being the depth of culture and diversity, mm-hmm. Is home to a number of refugees. The IRC in New York resettles about 200 to 300 refugees a year from diverse countries around the globe. And each year, refugees come to New York City and rebuild their lives.
You said 200 to 300 a year. That seems like a small number. Is that so?
It's a small number in comparison to the global number of refugees,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
About 70,000 refugees are approved for admission to the United States each year.
All right. Well, and, you know, we'll talk about Iraq later, but certainly the numbers are quite small. So Fatou and Mo, aside from the, you know, number crunching and what it sounds like, you've lived this experience. Fatou, let's begin with you. Tell us your story. You left Liberia with your family, correct?
Yes.
What's your story? Why are you a refugee?
I'm a refugee because when I was little in Liberia, when the war began, 1990, we have to leave because they were killing the Mandingos. Usually they were looking for the Mandingo, and we were Mandingo, we speak it.
Mm-hmm. So it's an ethnic group?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So basically the war was all about.
You're talking about the Civil War?
Yes.
In your country? Okay.
Yes. So in that time, I was very little, me and my brothers.
Okay.
And me and my mom, she has to take us and leave the country. She got beaten by the rebels. Mm-hmm. And also my uncle was killed and my dad too.
Yeah. So you lost your father and you lost your uncle.
Yes.
How did your mom take you and your brother? How did you escape the Civil War?
When we escaped from Liberia itself, we went to the village. I can't really remember the name because I was very little that
sure.
time. Yeah.
How old were you about?
I was about this size. I can. Yeah.
Okay, so you're pointing to you being just a little guy. Okay,
yes.
A little gal.
So then it was a car that was taking people from there coming to Guinea. Mm-hmm. So we were permitted to get on the cars and get in Guinea. And we didn't take nothing with us. Everything was
with the clothes on your back, you just fled. Your mom took you out.
Yes.
How terrifying was that experience?
It was very, very bad. And it was so good that we escaped out of it. They didn't kill us.
Did you understand what was happening? Do you remember that your mom was trying to take you out? Or was it just, did it happen quickly, within a day, within a night?
Well, it happened, like, quickly, because I can remember, like, when they came, when we escaped from Liberia, we went to the village where we settled mm-hmm. so we can continue our journey for mm-hmm. the next day. When the rebel came there, that was the time they killed my uncle and my grandma and my dad. Because when they came, they found that people that was in that place, they speak Mandingo.
So they were targeting your ethnic minority.
Yes.
So how did you come to the United States?
Well, it was the resettlement. Mm-hmm. My older sister that was here, she applied. And
she was already in the United States?
Yes, with her husband, yeah.
And so she applied for you?
Yes.
And your brother?
And my mom. Yes.
So you've actually been in this country how long?
2 years.
What's that experience been like for you?
It's been a great experience for me because I have experienced a lot in my life. And
yes, you have.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I just want to take that as a great opportunity to continue my life and not thinking about what I've been through.
Do you have nightmares? Do you watch the news looking for news about Liberia? Do you try to forget about it? What do you do?
Well, I read it. I want to look at news sometimes because for most of the time I look at the news, it's mostly about refugee, like in Darfur and other countries. Mm-hmm. The population have increased, like the poverty have increased. People are living bad conditions. Mm-hmm. And I also think like myself being in that situation that I'm mm-hmm. thankful that I've been here today and getting a best education and a better life.
Are you in school? Are you going to college? Are you in high school?
I'm in high school now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how is that?
It's very fabulous. Good.
You think you're pretty much an average New York young woman?
Yes.
Have you had therapy? Have you talked to counselors? How have you overcome the trauma of your loss, the loss of your family members, and what has to be a pretty jarring change coming to this country only 2 years ago?
Well, me and my counselor, we never talk like about what I've been through.
You don't?
No. I guess it's only one of my teachers in the school who already know what
Is
I've been
right?
through. Yeah. She knows how the life of us was like, because she knows that I'm a refugee. Yes.
But you are grateful to be in this country now?
Yes. Mm.
Thank you for your insights. We'll ask you more about that in a minute. Mo, let me turn to you. Your story is different. Your father was a political dissident.
Yes.
Tell me your story.
My father, he's pretty much active since he was in college.
Mm-hmm. In Burma,
if you heard about the 8-4, it's August 8, 1988, mm-hmm. where they have the big against the government to run the elections. And
Correct.
As the result, Aung San Suu Kyi, she won the election and is supposed to be that she in control of the country and run the democratic way.
Right, Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the author of that book, Freedom from Fear,
yes.
and who's a pro-democracy leader in Burma.
Yes, mm-hmm. and my dad is a co-founder of a political party, Shan Party, mm-hmm. SNLD. So he tried to run election, and he ended up second, the highest winning. But
this was what year that he ran for?
Yeah,
he ran for what office?
It's a party.
Okay.
SNLD is a political party.
Okay.
I think there's a total of 6 parties run for the election.
I see.
In that year, and as you know, Aung San Suu Kyi win the election, but things never change. You know, they're taking control, and until right now, the military is in control. Nothing happened, but my father never gave up, and he kept pushing it until the end of the line.
So your father was essentially fighting for democracy,
yes,
in Burma.
Yeah.
And why did he feel that he had to escape and take you and his and the family out of Burma?
Right. I was kind of young. I was 10 years old that time. The Burmese will send their soldiers to our house and just take my dad once a week and just bring him somewhere that I don't understand.
They would come to your home and take your father,
yeah,
literally.
Yeah.
At gunpoint?
Pardon me?
At gunpoint? How did they drag him out?
They cannot use the gun because the city we live is a capital city of the Shan state. So it's not really a good way to force people by gun. They don't show it, but you know you don't want to force them because anything can happen. But the time really come at the point, 1999, when they're afraid it's going to happen 9/4, which is September 9th, mm-hmm, 1999. They're afraid that it's going to be another more revolution as the 8/4.
Mm-hmm.
So finally...
So an uprising.
Yes, uprising. Mm-hmm. So they've been stalking my dad for a month. In front of my house, they follow my dad wherever he goes.
Just harassing him,
exactly,
essentially, and trying,
exactly,
to intimidate him.
So
okay,
at that point, he really think that we're not safe anymore. Mm-hmm. As a result, we apply for... not apply for, but we flew to Thailand. We have a terrible life in Thailand.
What year did you leave for Thailand?
1999. We left there, and I was 13 years old. My brother was 14, you know, as an illegal immigrant. No work, no school.
You flew to Thailand,
yeah,
and you just
lost
just,
everything.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You left with nothing. You left everything behind in Burma.
Yeah. No family. We just left 4 of us, me, my parents, and my older brother in Thailand.
Where did you live in Thailand?
We just live by day by day, you know. And we are lucky that we don't have to live in a camp, but mm-hmm, it's not physical. It's mentally challenging. Think about you, 13 or 14. You look at a young child wearing the uniform, going to school, and now you are over here working day and night.
Well, it's an incredible story. We're going to pick up on that conversation in just a minute. We're talking about the reality of the world refugee crisis, and that's part of our underreported feature today. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. If you want to give us a shout, please do so. Call us at 212-433-9692. If you've got a comment, an experience, or something thoughtful to say about the refugee crisis around the globe, we'll take a quick break. I'm Alice Reese, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and as part of our underreported feature today, we're talking about the world refugee crisis. Yesterday was World Refugee Day, in case you missed it. And I want to pick up on a conversation with a young woman, Monam Tikam. She's 20, she's Burmese, and she arrived in New York about 3 years ago via Thailand. So let's pick up on your story. You lived in Thailand as an illegal immigrant.
Yes.
And then you made your way, and it sounds like there was some real hardship there.
Yeah. As you know, Thai government never signs any agreement with UNHCR, so they're not
supportive. With the Commission on High Refugees,
yes.
Okay.
So they're not supportive of refugee.
I see.
So there's no guarantee for job or for education.
Okay.
So my dad finally looked for that country so that we can settle.
So you live there with no work, no money,
very
little money?
Yep. Me and my brother is the only two can find work because they don't want to hire my parents. Since they don't speak Thai that much, they're old, so they're not really, you know.
So you and your brother were doing what sort of work to support your family?
Any kind.
What?
Cleaning, selling. My brother had, I'm myself is a pretty easy job. In store, you sell stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
basically it. But my brother had to carry 40 to 50 kilos of stuff every day. Wake up in the 7 in the morning.
Hmm.
Think about it, he's 14, 15, 16, 3 years. How would it, you know? And we live in our country with peaceful and everything, and suddenly everything is gone. But hopefully
wow.
we became a refugee and we get a chance to reset in the United States in summer 2004.
You came to the U.S.
Yes.
Through the UNHCR. How did you come here?
We come with help of UNHCR, of course, mm-hmm. and then IRC.
Which is the International Refugee
yes.
Organization.
Yes, they support everything. We came here with nothing, not even a dollar. We depend on IRC help. We depend on government support, food stamp. And right now, I think we're doing pretty good. I mean, we, my dad managed to mortgage an apartment. I'm in Dickinson College, which is one of the best, liberal arts college. My brother's have a job. He's going to his college, and my mom have a job. So everything has turned out pretty good.
That's got to be a relief.
Yes, it is.
Are you just so grateful every day?
Yes, I am. Sometimes, you feel down no matter what. Mm-hmm. You know, you go through a lot, but sometimes it's really hit you sometimes, like, wait, why are you not at the mm-hmm. same level of success with some people? And I just have to lay back and relax and not put pressure on myself because I've been through a lot and I have to take it slowly.
And I want to point out your English is fantastic.
Thank you.
And you picked that up how and when?
I became a translator in Thailand for a couple of times.
Is that right?
Yeah, I translate between Thai, Burmese, Chan, and English since I was young. I really don't learn English that much, but from listening and translating,
yeah,
I catch up.
Now, Mo, you're 20, but how old do you really feel?
I don't know. I mean, 20 is pretty old for me. I mean, I'm fresh. My first year in my Dickinson College, we live in campus, small campus. You know, we have a RA floor meeting, and everyone introduced themselves and said, mm-hmm. I'm 20. People were like, what are you doing? 20? I mean, you're going to be 21 soon, and what are you doing freshman in college? But I told them, you want to know about me? Come talk to me. Right. I will share about my story. And after they know my story, they were like, wow, you've been through a lot. So for me, 20 is... it's pretty old.
You know, let me ask this question to both of you, Fatu and Mo. Do you look at your lives and do you struggle with bitterness or anger about what you've been through? Or is it just like coming away from a car accident thinking, I'm lucky to be alive?
For me, it's kind of like I'm from a car accident and I'm being alive. Yes. Because when I was like in Guinea, when I came, the education there, I wasn't really thinking that I'm going to make it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't thinking, like, when I'm finished, I was thinking, like, when I'm done with high school, what am I going to do? What mm-hmm. am I going to be? But when I found myself, like, I had to come to the United States that everybody is dreaming to come to, it was a great, great opportunity for me.
Sure. Yeah. Well, what about you? You're just happy to be here. Do you struggle with bitterness about the past?
Yeah, I'm grateful to be here, you know. Anger, of course, yes.
Angry at who or what?
When I was young, I have no idea. I'm still young, but I take a lot of anger to my dad. I blame him a lot. Because of him, we have to left our big family and happy life and stuff. But until today, I understand why he's been pushing hard. I mean, my story is nothing compared to other people mm-hmm. in my own who struggle in my country.
You mean angry at your dad because he was a political activist.
Yes.
Did you want him to give that up?
I wanted to. I even talked to him last year, but right now he's in Norway doing his political thing.
Is that right?
They have the human rights conference, and mm-hmm. he went there already. Now today they start a conference.
I mean,
he will never stop it. I think it's in the blood of him.
It's in his blood. Yeah. Christine, these young women, thank you for sharing your stories.
You're welcome.
They are, compelling and in some ways just unbelievable as I sit across and look at their very young faces and you see how they've lived. What is it like for you as someone who works on the front lines with these people?
Well, clearly these two young women are resilient and a typical example of refugees who come to the U.S. and rebuild their lives. For those of us who are fortunate enough to work with them, the reward is in our work.
Mm-hmm.
As you heard from them, they arrived in the U.S. with virtually nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very typical of refugees. They've given everything up, really in the name of freedom. And they come to the U.S. and they're eager to rebuild their lives and restore their livelihoods.
Now, I know that you're not a political activist necessarily, but are you satisfied with what this country is doing to help resettle refugees? Are you satisfied with American policy toward refugees?
I think the U.S. has always had a humanitarian obligation to mm-hmm. assist refugees, and I think the U.S. has recognized that obligation. Mm-hmm. As a worker in the humanitarian field, I would be remiss if I didn't say more refugees should come to the mm-hmm. U.S. When you look at the number of refugees worldwide and the number admitted to the mm-hmm. U.S., it's a very small number.
What kind of percentage are we talking?
We're talking about less than 1%.
So this country, the United States, accepts less than 1% of the world's refugee population.
That's correct.
You know, what do you want our listeners to know about the plight of refugees who come into this country? How can they help? How can they get involved?
I think what I'd like listeners to recognize is that refugees come to the U.S., they work hard, they're eager to restore their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. Americans, specifically New Yorkers, have always been generous in supporting our refugee program, providing us with contributions, working mm-hmm. as volunteers, helping refugees learn English. And I think they are truly amazed at the resiliency mm-hmm. among our refugees.
Now, when you say people can volunteer, where do they go to volunteer? And what does that look like? Taking someone shopping? Introducing them to the city? What does that look like?
Well, you could imagine arriving in New York City as mm-hmm. a refugee with...
My goodness.
With just your belongings.
Yeah.
It can be overwhelming.
I mean, just reading a subway map on a bad day is rough for me.
Absolutely.
Okay? So...
So our volunteers serve as family mentors. Uh-huh. They help refugees navigate the transit system.
Yeah.
They help them with shopping for groceries.
Mm-hmm. Basic things that you wouldn't know to do. What is cottage cheese? What is this item? What is, right?
Right.
You know, let me just transition to you, Mo and Fatou, again. When you got to this country, what were some of the surprising things or things that you just thought, where am I living? I'm on another planet. I mean, I didn't realize that there was mail delivery on Saturday. I came to New York and Canada, you don't deliver mail on the weekends. It took me several months before somebody mentioned that to me. So, and I'm just from, you know, a little north of here. So really, what did you have to get used to?
Well, for me, I had to get used to the subway.
What about the subway?
I got lost. I got lost when I first came. And then I don't know who to ask because I'm afraid because the English everybody's speaking in mine is not the same. So I don't know if when I ask someone, like, I'm lost. And I don't even know the building I was living in because in my country, there's no number on the buildings. You just direct the place to people. You go this way, you bend, and you go right. That's it. But I got to think, like, what is the number on my building? Uh-huh. What am I going to tell this?
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
That's a great story. What about you, Mo?
I had a really hard time, same as Subway. But I overthink it right now at this point. United States is such a lay-low and easy country. You don't even have to do anything.
What do you mean it's an easy country?
You have a subway, you have a bus, you have a service, you have uh-huh. everything. Technology is like way ahead of my country. It's so convenient.
Mm.
It's even make you lazy sometimes, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
Lazy.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. What about the food? Anything weird you thought, what is this? What is it that Americans eat?
It started with me on the plane. When I first got on the plane,
uh-huh.
I was given pizza.
Pizza.
And broccoli and other things. I didn't eat no. I was starving.
Why didn't you eat it?
Because I didn't have that taste. It didn't taste that in my mouth. Like,
you just thought, what is this?
In my country, what the food I eat is rice.
I see.
Everyday rice.
So you looked at this pizza.
So
what did you think of it?
I was like, what is this? I don't know. And for every time they bring in food, they bring in different kind of food. I was just drinking, because I'm not used to the food. I love pizza.
Let me tell our listeners, I'm Alice Reese sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking about the world refugee crisis as part of our underreported segment today. And among the challenges that refugees face, things that you would not think of naturally, but just some of the peculiarities of adjusting to a new country and New York City. And some Americans think New York City is a different planet anyway. So, Mo, what about you? Any other peculiar adjustments you've had to make?
I went to college in Pennsylvania this year, two semester. It's been different to see differences between Carlisle, small town, and New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, New York City, people in a fast move 24/7. I mean, you really have to catch up with the time.
I see.
I think the time in New York City is move faster two times than the other places.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about the refugees who don't make it here. You both look to me like success stories, but I have to wonder what happens to the people who don't make it to New York City, who aren't accepted as refugees or who live in camps. What is their plight, Christine?
Well, unfortunately, many refugees are stuck in limbo.
Yeah.
They're in protracted refugee camp situations.
All over the world.
All over the world, sometimes for more than a decade, sometimes longer.
Wow.
And for those refugees, they're waiting it out. They're waiting to see if it will ever be safe to go back to their countries. They're waiting to see if the host country they're in will allow them to integrate locally.
What is the bureaucracy, the paperwork like to become a refugee, particularly in this country? I mean, I know that the green card process here is arduous, and that's being diplomatic. So what is that experience? Like, how overwhelming is that?
Well, it's a very lengthy process for refugees. So it starts again with their initial registration with...
When you say lengthy, are we talking a year? Are we talking 2 years?
We're talking anywhere from a year to 5 or 10 years in some situations. From the first time they apply...
5 to 10 years?
Yes.
So in that interim, while they're applying, what's their status? Are they out in the ether? What is that like?
They're living as refugees, typically in refugee camp settings.
I see. So the paperwork begins, and what do you have to prove? What's the documentation?
Well, a refugee would have to demonstrate that they have a well-founded fear of persecution, generally because of their political or religious affiliations, mm-hmm. similar to Mo's family. And then they would need to go through a series of interviews. And in mm-hmm. order to be accepted to the U.S. refugee program, mm-hmm. they would have to be approved by the U.S. government for admission.
Wow. Let's take a call right now. I've got Paul from Connecticut. Paul?
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, welcome to Leonard Lopate Show.
Well, I just wanted to encourage your refugee guests to...
Fatou and Mo. Mm-hmm.
To get involved somehow with, you know, with politics or a cause here in this country. It sickens me that too few people in this country even take advantage of the fact that we have the right to vote when people around the world are risking their lives to gain the right to vote. So please don't just sit back. Get involved somehow. The world needs you. This country needs you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. Ladies, do you want to respond to that? What do you think of what our caller just said?
Thank you, Paul, first of all. It's great. Yeah, you really remind of, you know, people not using the opportunity to vote. I mean, voting can change a lot, and you're right. We should take advantage of what we have.
You know, let's talk about Iraq. I was staggered. I actually spoke with my producer, Sarah, again this morning and said, can we just double-check these facts? She pulled up a document from the State Department that showed the number of refugees from Iraq that this country has accepted in the fiscal year 2007, okay? The number was 70. Now, there's a total from 2003 onward to about early this year, and I think that number is about 200 or 300. What's your reaction to that? The way that this country is absorbing refugees from Iraq. Christine.
Well, we would like the U.S. to do more for Iraqi refugees. What we have is a large-scale, perhaps the greatest humanitarian and refugee crisis of our time.
Now, you say that very calmly, but when you say you'd like the U.S. to do more, are you outraged? Do you think that they've done enough? I mean, the number is I really had to double check it. I couldn't believe it. 70 this fiscal year thus far. Is that a staggeringly small amount?
It is a staggering small amount. We would like to see more Iraqi refugees come to the U.S. There's an immediate need for resettlement among Iraqi refugees.
Is it a desperate situation?
It is a desperate situation. Millions of Iraqi citizens right now mm-hmm. are displaced, both inside Iraq and in neighboring countries throughout
Jordan,
the Middle East.
Jordan,
Syria, Lebanon.
Uh-huh. What is desperate about their situation? I mean, other than really the obvious things that you see on television, you see these, what's desperate for an international humanitarian worker? What do they lack?
Well, right now, I think Iraqis who have fled Iraq have quickly run out of resources, and they've used pretty much their life savings to escape Iraq and to live in a host country.
So they're broke. They have left their family behind, and they essentially have nothing, is what you're
Correct.
Saying.
And no prospects for return to Iraq in the immediate future.
Are there any countries that have been particularly generous or welcoming for Iraqi refugees?
Well, I think if you look at the numbers, Jordan, almost 1 million refugees mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. Syria, another 1 million or so. What happens in a host country is the host country grows tired of the situation.
Right.
And their resources are also strained, and they're also looking for a solution to the problem.
I don't know that you can answer this, but what needs to happen to resettle these refugees? And I don't mean just Iraqi refugees, this millions of people who are displaced. Is it that we need governments to come together and cooperate? Is it that we need money? Does it need to be private organizations? Where does the help need to come from?
Well, I think we need to look at why people are refugees in the first place and what can we do to prevent refugee crises worldwide. Unfortunately, throughout the decades, refugees have always existed, and the situation doesn't seem like it will be resolved anytime soon. So in the meantime, I think it will take a joint effort among international non-government organizations, U.S. government, UNHCR, host country representatives, and I think everybody needs to work together to find a durable solution to the world's refugees.
Right, and you keep using the word durable solution, meaning we can't just throw money at this and we can't just wish it away, essentially.
That's correct.
Essentially.
And the U.S. refugee program, fortunately, is set up for permanent resettlement in the U.S.
Great. Well, this certainly feels to me like an ideal topic to call underreported. I've certainly learned so much. I want to thank my guests, Mo, Fatu. Your courage is really inspirational. And I do wish you the very best in this great city of all the places to be.
Thank
Christine
you.
With the IRC. Thank you so much for being with me and for really, I think, shedding some light on this topic. We'll be back.